let's have an AA meeting. My name is Amy and I am an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday night Blue Chip speaker meeting at the Nava Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more sobriety tells his or her story.
This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. Tonight, Oliver T. joins us. I live in Gainesville, Georgia, and I have run into Oliver in the rooms up there. Privilege of hearing his story about 2 months ago, I guess, right? Get ready. It's something else. You might be, after hearing his story, I got a feeling most of us are not going to be drinking tonight. Okay? Come on up, Oliver.
My name's Oliver. I'm an alcoholic. Sobriety dates. Ooh, this is on wheels. My sobriety dates July 2nd, 2017. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor. I'm available to sponsor other men. I have a home group. My home group is the Fifth Tradition group. First of all, I'd like to thank Tim for asking me to speak tonight, and Napa. That's an old, probably the oldest still existing clubhouse in all of Atlanta. I can only imagine the amount of sobriety you guys have heard from this podium tonight, and I'm very honored to be here among you guys, asked to share my experience, strength, and hope on the subject. So for that, I'm grateful. I enjoy the opportunity to be of service today. I've come to find that only through being of service to others do I get any real relief from this thing that I suffer from, which is alcoholism. I do believe I've had alcoholism from as long as I can remember. I remember being young and growing up and really being fascinated with doing things that didn't make sense at the time. I had this thing where I would stay up all night, stay up as far as I could into the next morning to get that sleepy, delirious feeling, because something about it, it was just, I was going for it. You know, I'd grab a six-pack of Mountain Dew and some R-rated movies from Blockbuster, and I'd have a hell of a time, you know, doing my own thing. And it would be like a competition with my friends, you know, who could last the longest, you know. And then at some point I'm fading in and out of being asleep, and I remember just absolutely loving that feeling. And at the time I couldn't have told you why, you know. Some kids spin in circles, you know. I stayed up as long as I could. It was probably one of my first experiences changing how I felt, although I was unaware that was what I was doing at the time. You know, normal childhood life. I had an older brother. He was a great example of what not to do. So he was a lot of fun. He was a lot of fun to be around. Really active as a kid. Played lots of sports. I remember I had a pretty much like a best friend who I played baseball with, and I was over at his house, and his parents were like, they were atheists, but they were like super strict atheists. They were like, had tons of rules, especially like dietary rules. I remember they always ordered water when they went out to eat. No one ever got any kind of soda. It just like baffled me as to how they could manage the self-restraint to pull something like that off. But I remember they had given us some type of candy. I want to say it was Gushers, but I'm not entirely sure. And my friend observed the way that I ate these candies. And aghast, he looked at me and said, "Dude, you're a junkie." He did. I was about 7 years old. And I didn't know what he meant. But I could tell from the kind of the connotation and the way he delivered it that it was probably not a positive thing to be called. And how true his prediction in the long run turned out to be. I remember growing up, I always, you know, even as early as elementary school, certainly by middle school, I always valued what other people thought of me to the utmost. It didn't matter what I had or what I had going for me. If you believed I had it going for me, that was good enough for me. If you believed that I was sleeping with a pretty girl, that was fine. I could have never touched her before, but if you thought I had, I was okay with that. I remember having lots of friends whose parents had a lot more money than my parents, and if you thought my parents were better off than they were because of who I hung out with, then that was good enough for me. And looking back, I see how that type of thinking over time can really, really get somebody sick, but that's I took to it right away. And that's kind of always how I lived in my head. I had lots of friends. Growing up, elementary and middle school was not too abnormal. I had tons of advantages in life. I was in a gifted program. I did really well in school. And later on, I still did well. I made good grades, but I was a terrible, terrible student, if that makes any sense to anybody in here, you know. But I remember something big happened around the age of 13. Remember, I was at home, and I was having dinner. It was Dairy Queen. It was a chicken tender box from Dairy Queen with a Sprite. Okay, I remember this. And the phone rings, and that older brother is on the other end. And he's calling, and he's telling my parents that apparently he's in jail in Fulton County, and it's not good. It's really bad. It was so bad, it turned out, that he did 10 years consecutive in prison for what he was calling from jail about, begging to be bonded out. And I remember hearing my parents cry, and I remember talking to him on the phone, and I remember crying. But the very next thing I remember was, what are people going to think? How does this affect me? I'm not going to have a big brother from the time until, you know, for the foreseeable future. It turned out to be from the time I was 13 until 23. And it was just all immediately about, I'm not the one in jail, I'm not the one going to prison, but I might as well have been the way I felt, because I was very consumed with how these things affected me and my standing. Let me backtrack a little. When I was 9 years old, I went out to Canyon City, Colorado. My mom's from Colorado, and although I was born in Noonan, Georgia, believe it or not. And I went out there, and my cousin, he is 7 days younger than me, and we were nine, and he was bad. He was like a very bad nine-year-old. Like, he would rip the filters off Marlboro Reds and smoke them at nine, right? I mean, seriously. I mean, that's what he was doing at 9 years old. And I remember my aunt, and she's one of us. She's passed away now, but she walked out of the room, and he went underneath the kitchen cabinet and grabbed this big plastic bottle with clear liquid in it. It turned out to be a cheap plastic handle of vodka. And I remember him pouring as much as he could into a red Solo cup before he topped it off with Sunkist. And I remember drinking that with him, and I didn't like the way it tasted, and I felt something. But he drank a whole lot. And then we rode around on the back of his dirt bike all through this little small town in Colorado, and I remember thinking, hey, this is pretty fun. I also remember him throwing up and us getting caught. Turns out that, I guess, Barton's and Sunkist does not sit well on a nine-year-old's stomach, come to find out, being all of 70 pounds. And I remember enjoying that, but the thing is, I don't remember thinking about drinking again after that. It happened, and it was like kind of fun, I guess, but it really wasn't something that even like registered on my radar as something I might want to do again. And after my brother was in jail waiting to go to prison, he had been arrested, and he had a handle of Jack Daniels left, and my parents had moved it. I'd moved into his room, and they'd hidden it once again underneath a kitchen cabinet. And I was a pretty good kid. Like, I had really good grand. I don't think they suspected that I would try and drink any of it, but I had a friend who had an older brother, and his older brother was beginning to drink, so we kind of knew that, like, drinking was this, like, cool kind of taboo thing that kids around, you know, 7th, 8th grade, early high school were doing. And I wanted in, and we mixed some of that Jack Daniels with Dr. Pepper, and I remember it tasted so horrible. And all throughout my drinking, I absolutely despised whiskey. I turned out to be a vodka drinker and a gin drinker. I absolutely hated the taste of whiskey. And I remember after a few sips, just not physically not being able to stomach any more of this. It was so bad. And it was awful. But he drank a lot of it, and I saw the effect it produced with him. And I remember thinking, you know, I'm going to find the right mix. I want what he has. You know, and he was laughing. I mean, he was laughing. He turned red in the face. He was laughing hysterically. He was clearly having a good time, a better time than I was, sitting there with four sips of Jack Daniels and Dr. Pepper in my stomach, thinking about poor me because my brother's in prison. You know, he was definitely enjoying the night more than I was. Going forward from there, I finally worked up the guts in ninth grade and made the proper connections to purchase alcohol on my own. There was a kid who had been failed so many times in whatever class I was taking. I think it was, I couldn't even tell you, some social studies type of class. And he had a fake ID, I found out. And how he ever purchased alcohol with this fake ID is baffling, because he looked about 12. But somehow he was convincing this liquor store that every weekend he was buying for a wedding. And he would he told me that's the line he used, and there must have been some truth to it, because he would come back with cases of booze, handles and handles and handles, and he would shop for everyone in that high school. And I made my first purchase. For $20, I purchased two handles of Barton's vodka. That was my first ever alcohol purchase, was 1 gallon of Rot Gut vodka, which turned out to be a great indicator of things to come. You know, I was always a Rot Gut vodka drinker. I liked it room temperature and about $3 a pint. And that's just how I rolled. That's what I enjoyed. I mean, that's what I had taste for. As awful as that sounds, that's what I liked. And I remember going to a friend's house with my other friend, who we'd had the Jack Daniels experience with. And I remember taking shots of this vodka, and I remember something happening. I remember that feeling that I had been trying to get rid of for the longest time through your attention and your approval and staying up really late or practicing at sports for hours and hours and hours. I took 3 or 4 shots of this liquid, and it was all gone. I've heard it described this way so many times before, but it was really true that those promises came true for me right then and there. You know, I comprehended the word serenity, and I knew peace. Situations that used to baffle me, I could handle. I could see that alcohol was going to do for me what I could not do for myself. And it was clear. And I wanted more from that very first time. I remember we were on the phone calling other ninth grade high school girls, and I can only imagine how ridiculous we must have sounded. But we were, and my friend's trying to play this song on acoustic guitar through the phone to this girl, and this, you know, this is what you would imagine 14 or 15 year old kids drinking Rot Gut vodka at their parents' house would do. That's what we were into. And I believe I've had that alcoholism, that I self in me, for a long time. But from that first drink, I experienced the phenomenon of craving. And it wasn't until I got sober that I was able to look back and realize that every time I drank alcohol, I got drunk. Every single time. When I wasn't drinking or changing how I felt, I was thinking about it. It was constant. And little did I know that in 12, 18 months, I definitely qualified for a seat in this room at 15 or 16 years old. I most certainly did, although that would not become clear to me for some time later. I had some scary things kind of happen to me or happen around me in high school. I had a girl I was very close with. If you know what, as close as a 15-year-old boy can be to another 15-year-old girl, she was found dead on the side of a road from a cocaine overdose. She had been put in the closet at this drug house, and she died in the closet because she had a bad reaction. And they decided to leave her body on the side of the road and wait for someone to find her. And I remember thinking, you know, that's sad. That's terrible. But that doesn't really affect me. That should not really inform any decisions I'm making, because that's her. That's not me. Never mind, we hung out all the time, went to all the same places with all the same people. That was, you know, while sad, once again, that's kind of her mistake. And I was kind of able to brush it off. I was very focused on myself and what I wanted and how I felt. And thinking and feeling sorry for her was not conducive to me having a good time, so I really didn't. Then the same thing happened the next year. Although this was probably my best male friend at the time. His dad was a pharmacist, and he was stealing from his dad's work. And I woke up, and my best friend's dead next to me. And I remember thinking, for the second time, my mom had tried to kill herself once when I was 15, and I had sworn off drugs and alcohol in a minute. But when this happened to me when I was 16, I knew then that this affected me, that this way of living was not a positive way of living. I remember watching his parents be told by the paramedics that their son was dead, and that was awful. I remember 20 cop cars, fire trucks, and ambulances. I remember the GBI talking to me and almost being taken downtown for investigation or questioning or what. They wouldn't have gotten. I mean, I was 16 and completely destroyed on alcohol and other things at the time. They wouldn't have gotten anything coherent out of me, but I remember then that I swore, and I really, really meant it this time. I wasn't going to drink again. I wasn't going to do anything else again. I would have passed a lie detector with flying colors. There was a lot. That was a serious consequence. And it lasted 6 days. 6 full days, I did not change how I felt with the drink or anything else. But on day 7, I say alcoholic's magic words, you know, screw it. You know, I was very focused on how his death would affect how I was viewed in this high school and in this still very small town in 2004. You know, it wasn't everybody knew everybody, and now I'm the kid who, if your kid hangs out with me, well, look what happens. You know, I went through high school being snuck into parties through the back door where the parents wouldn't know. If the parents knew I was there, then I would have to leave, right? And that's how I became used to living. And that was a very uncomfortable way to live. And so to manage this fear, and now I see it as fear management. That's most of my defects work in me managing my own fears instead of trusting God. And I managed my fear by just not feeling anything. I got deeper into alcohol. I got deeper into anything that would take me out of myself and would do it the cheapest, best way possible. And that's the type of life that I was happy to live. And at times that there was fun. At times there were decent moments, but over time it became clear that I can't control this. I certainly can't control it once I start. Now, the stopping, about age 18, I had made up my mind that the stopping was just a matter of being fully detoxed. That was all it was going to be. 3 or 4 weeks with nothing in my system, then not only will I be able to choose to do it or not, but once I start, I'll be able to choose how much. I mean, it was pretty clear that, like, that was the problem, that I've screwed up and I've been taking this stuff and drinking this stuff for so long that I just need a good 3 or 4 weeks to dry out. That's all. You know, I went off to Columbus State very, very sick at 19 years old, and that was a complete waste of time and money. I was more interested in the women and the alcohol than anything else at that point. I remember an incident leaving a gas station on foot with 2 40-ounce Budweisers, and I dropped one on the way back to the dorm apartments, and I dropped the other one on my big toe. I had just made fun of a friend of mine who was in a frat for jumping over a fire and not making it over and landing in the fire and a beer bottle exploding into his foot. He was on crutches, and I'd been making fun of him so much that the next week I dropped a 40-ounce on my toe and split it wide open. We both had foot injuries from alcohol glass, believe it or not. It's a common thing in Columbus, I guess. Luckily, I had a friend who was a really big punk rocker type guy whose belt buckle was a big safety pin, and he undid it and sterilized it and dug all this glass that had gotten in the bottom of my foot out, and that wasn't a consequence. That was a fun story. But as time went on, the amount of people I could impress with my drinking and drugging became less and less. before coming in these rooms, I wouldn't have told you that I have a physical allergy, right, or a mental obsession. I would have said, I can drink and do everything else more than you. That's an asset. In my world, that's an asset. That's, like, definitely something cool to have. I wouldn't have told you that I have this mental obsession that always walks me back to the first drink. I would have told you I changed my mind. It's my mind to change. It always looks like I'm changing my mind. It presents itself in a very clever way to me, disguising it as my choice and something I'm choosing to do. And it did for a long time. After coming back from school, I ended up, there was the 2006-07-08 thing happened. I don't know exactly when that happened, but sometime around then, I had to go live with an uncle of mine who actually lived in Forsyth County. I have nothing positive to say about Forsyth County. However, the one thing that I can tell you from my story at Forsyth County, I had strayed from my first love of alcohol for a couple of years now. I was still drinking, but it was not my main thing. When I got to Forsyth County, I didn't have those people around me. But I remembered one day that I was 21 years old. This is the type of things I have to remember sometimes. And I realized down at the liquor store, being as that I'm 21, let's go see them. And I remember 50-cent airplane bottles of Taka became very, very nifty, convenient things to purchase with my uncle's change jar. Or from my aunt's purse. Or, resourcefulness was the name of the game. Being 21 and unemployed, living with an uncle in a county you're not from. So I began to do that, and I got a job. I got a job at a sub shop, which is a great job for a guy. I mean, if you're out there, a sub shop is the way to go for employment. I mean, very little accountability, flexible hours. As long as you're not throwing up on the line or falling backwards, you're good to go. The only problem for me about this job was it was on exit 14 on Marketplace Boulevard, right in the corner between Walmart and Home Depot, and it faced this big store called Jack's. Like, this was like a liquor warehouse. I mean, this was not your normal liquor store, guys. This was like a liquor emporium. And this funny thing happened about right after the lunch rush, or the dinner rush, rather, every day. I've been staring at this store for so long, thinking about that pint for $3.24, or that half pint for $2.13, that I knew I could purchase. And as soon as there was the first gap in that dinner line and that rush died, there I was. And I had to have that half pint to calm me down to close the store. I was fine then. I was great. I was cleaning. I was counting money. I was delegating. Somehow I was, like, in charge of closing the store and counting the money, which is actually what led me not to have that job, was the counting of the money. Got a little bit more. Not so much that as the non-ringing up of the food and the pocketing of the money. That was really what got me. I was always pretty decent at repaying the money that I took from the safe because I knew that would get noticed. And I started to hear these words my friends would use. And these are party people, mind you. They would start to use this word, "Stop being such an alky." So one of my friends said, "Dude, you're an alcoholic." I started to hear this stuff, and I'm like, whoa, we all party here. I am no different than any other of you guys. You guys might just have a little bit of more stuff right now, but I'm coming. Like, I'll get, I'm 21. You know what I mean? Come on. Like, give a guy a break. But it just continued. It continued to the point where I was, buying a couple handles a week to get me through, and then drinking all day and drinking into the night. I remember waking up in a pile of dirty clothes with vomit everywhere. And my cell phone doesn't work because I've jumped in a pool. I remember waking up with scars because I've went dead weight in a driveway and just completely blacked out while standing up and lost my balance. I remember hearing stories about someone was in the pool and they asked for a towel, and I did like this, and I popped them in the face with it for no reason and then laughed. While that is kind of funny, we got to admit, it's not something I generally would have done. It's funny. I'd like to see it happen, but I wouldn't be the one doing it. This stuff starts to happen, black cans of 211 start to happen. Six pack of Tall Boys ice houses start to happen, like, all the time. And I'm not feeling very well in the mornings at this point. I'm waking up and I have an upset stomach every day. I have a headache every night. But being resourceful as I was, I figured out that two coffee mugs full of ice water made the headache go away. That's easy enough to manage. You know, it's not too bad of a problem to have. That's certainly nothing beyond my ability to control. But like the book says, gradually things got worse. I'm 29 years old now. It's 8 years later. I met a girl who I knew from middle school and high school, and it must have been the only reason that she messed with me is because she knew me from that long ago. That's all I can figure. If she would have met me later in life, there's no way she would have revisited a relationship with me, for sure. I'm living with her, and I'm starting to toy with the idea of getting clean and sober. Like, it's like if it were on a battle plan or a manual, I might read it once. Or like the Cliff Notes or something. I was becoming like somewhat willing to maybe sort of kind of get more material things. I didn't know how, but like it was clear by 29 that like, hey, this is kind of getting more towards the abnormal ages to be behaving like this. I used to remember her in a different light, and this shows how perspective is everything. They say that, the past is uncertain, and that is, because I can look back on something now that's happened in the past, and it looks one way, and 5 years from now, it'll look like an entirely different thing that's happened, depending on my perspective. And I used to really resent her for how it ended, but she had some suggestions for me. You know, physical exercise, hike, art, you know, art therapy, paint a picture, you know, just smoke weed. That's my favorite one, by the way, for people to use with us. It's not very effective, but it is somewhat fun. And I used to be mad at her for, like, none of that would have worked. How dare she try and help me the best she can with the knowledge that she has? I mean, that's how ungrateful I am. But she did tell me one thing. She told me there were meetings in downtown every noon and every 8 o'clock at night. Now, she said she can't go, being an alcoholic, which she was, because she doesn't believe in God and she wouldn't be allowed. And I took that on face value. I didn't know what you guys did here. I said, okay. And I could really hear her saying that you should start going to those, or you might not have a free place to stay, not have to work, be able to drive my car around, and be the general deadbeat scumbag that I was. So I took her advice. And I went to these meetings for about 90 days. I left most of them with less sobriety time than when the meeting started. That's a neat trick. You've never done that one. That's I walk in with 3 hours, leave with 20 minutes. That's I've done it more than once. I've done it more than 10 times. Done it more than 20 times. And it's, guys, that shit is miserable. I'm not mandated to AA. I have really no reason to be there other than being there on my own free will. And there I am every day loaded, sitting in an AA meeting, wondering, what can I do? Why isn't this working for me? And I've heard it described like this. The approach I was taking to AA would be like going to a meeting of bodybuilders. And I'm listening to them talk about their diets and their reps and their workout plans and what they do to work out. And after 30 days, I'm pissed off because I don't have abs. Right? I think that just by hearing them talk about working out, I should be fit. And that was my approach to AA. I thought that just listening to this enough would give me the ability to have what they have. But something happened over those 90 days. I began to have a little bit of hope. Just a little bit, because I still knew you guys with like 10 months or 2 years, or God forbid 5 or 10 years, were totally full of shit. But the people with like 60, 90 days, I kind of trusted a little bit more. I was like, well, shit, he's got 60 days. When you got 60 minutes, 60 days is That's a lifetime, you know. And I had some hope. And at some point, through God's grace, I was kicked out of that apartment I was living in. She caught me in a number of lies, seemingly all at once. And I came home from work, and I remember thinking, I'd gotten a job. It was my second day in which I was kicked out. Waffle House will hire anybody in South Atlanta. And I walked in, and her apartment looked different. And the cat even looked confused by how things were arranged. And it was all my stuff was right there at the door. That was what it was. It was totally all of my stuff was sitting next to the door, and there was a 4-page typed letter on top of my stuff. And I'll tell you what, that letter said everything that she loved about me, except for one paragraph. It said, "But things have changed. I can't trust you. You've lied to me. And now you need to leave." And that hurt. And that hurt, and I left. And a week later, I ended up in a park by myself, broke, busted, and disgusted, as they say, with no other option. And I began to feel a sickness come on to me, which I knew was going to be very extensive and long. So I called 911. And the paramedic showed up, and they said, "We got ourselves another one." I remember taking offense to that, because I thought I was like a miracle of health, you know, at 170 pounds and, you know, gaunt face and old clothes with burn holes all in the front, you know, old Deftone shirt with like 16 burn holes in it, you know. And I went to the hospital, and I remember I was covered in vomit, and I only saw the doctor for like 30 seconds, and there were two cops standing at the door. It's like, well, this escalated quickly, and I had been 10-13. You know, I was so sick that he had deemed that I was a danger to somebody. I couldn't have done anything. I was cripplingly sick, like Alex in A Clockwork Orange, like style sick. Like, I was not doing nothing. But, you know, and then they asked me if I wanted to go to a detox, and I said the first right word I had said in years. I said yes. And I was transported via a police car, and I remember I had had something that day, and I had the cop, you know, doing YouTube selections on the way, because I'm a music guy, and I was finding a little bit of relief in music, no matter how tragic my situation was, headed to detox. I remember being there for 7 days, and I remember being 159 pounds. I remember not being able to stand up in the shower, to take a shower, having to sit down. I was that weak. They asked me if I wanted to go home or what I wanted to do after that, and I may or may not have owed some people some money. That may have influenced my decision not to go home, but I chose to go to Atlanta to a program, and I knew a little, like I had like a sponsor in name only. I knew, like, I had like a vague idea of like how this is supposed to work, a little bit, kind of, you know what I mean? And so I went to Atlanta to a program, and I began to work my program, not the program. And it turns out my program sucks. My program will get me drunk every time. The program, it turns out, works. That was a distinction that I had to make. So I treated it like a buffet. Double scoop of fellowship. Pass on the prayer. Allergic. You know, stuff like that. And for like the third time in my life, I had promised that I wasn't going to drink, and I still drank. I made one of these deals that I tend to make when I'm really sick, and said, if this store sells the type of alcohol that I want, it's God's will that I drink it. You guys ever done anything super sick like that? Like, if the guy calls back before midnight, I'll buy it. You know, and then I'm texting him at 11:45. Hurry up, hurry up. You know, I try to avoid personal responsibility by putting things on God. It doesn't make sense now, but it was making sense then. And the second best thing that happened to me in 2017, besides Naomi kicking me out, was being discharged from that program. Now, if you had asked me a couple weeks after that, those were the two worst things that happened to me in 2017, for sure. Now, I can clearly see those are the two best things that happened to me that year, without a doubt. And I went home for 5 days, and I stayed loaded. I came back to the program after being up all night, lots of stuff, and Pabst Blue Ribbon. My last drink was Pabst Blue Ribbon. I don't know what that tells you about the type of drinker that I am, but I hope it tells you something. And I came back, and I remember going to sleep that night. And I remember waking up the next day, and something had changed. What had changed was I had taken the first step. I knew that I was going to work all 12 steps. I knew that I was going to be active at my home group. I knew that one day I would take other men through the steps. I knew that AA would become the center of my life. And something funny happened. A few weeks later, I'm sitting there reading the 12 and 12. My sponsor hadn't asked me to read the 12 and 12. I was just hungry. And I was reading, I think, step 2 out of the 12 and 12. I remember having this thought. I haven't thought about drinking in a couple weeks. And this is with like 25 days sober. And not to say that I had done the work that it often requires to have that happen for somebody, but it happened for me. And it happened just like that, and the thought of drinking has not returned since. I went through the steps, line by line, page by page, with the sponsor. I remember thinking, this is taking forever. I remember my sponsor saying, well, the reason that the doctor's opinion in the first 43 pages are about step one is alcoholics tend to need a lot of convincing as to how screwed they are. And that was true for me. I finally grasped this first step, which told me I'm screwed. What the first steps told me is I don't have the power to control this. I am screwed. And so I went on through the steps, and step two was fairly easy. I was willing to believe the 12 steps worked. That's all I had to do to complete step two. I was willing to believe that it was working for you guys. That was good enough for me. And I get to step three at a coffee shop. I'm getting on my knees with another man at a coffee shop. And I remember just being kind of mortified at the whole idea of it. But I did it. Because I was fresh out of ideas. I mean, I was just like all the way out. I didn't have any. Zero. So I was just doing whatever this guy told me to do to the best of my ability. And I remember after saying that third step prayer, we kept reading. And I was like, what? You know, it seems like that's a full course right there, you know, of humility and stuff. And he had me go home and start on my fourth step. And I understand that now. I understand that while that decision is vital and crucial, it's life-giving and it's important, it really ain't going to mean nothing if I don't follow it at once, which is right away, with an effort to face and be rid of these things which have been blocking me, right? So I went home and I started on that fourth step, and I was somewhat confused as to what I was supposed to be doing, but I did it, and I camped out on it 2 months. Only way I finished it was by telling my sponsor that I had finished it and scheduling a fifth step, and then I knew I would look like a liar if I didn't have it completed. That's not advice. That's just my experience with the fourth step. That's not a great way to make sure you finish it, but it worked for me. So I got to my sponsor's house for this fifth step, and I believe it was his first fifth step, although you wouldn't have been able to tell from how productive it was. It was just fascinating. To tell you the truth, it was really funny. I mean, there were some things on there that were kind of serious, that were intense, but for the most part, when he shared with me about his experiences, I realized that this guy, while mild-mannered and kind of squeaky clean, was definitely like super sick. You know, and that gave me a little bit of hope right then and there. We did the fifth step in 3-hour increments, and I did it for 5 weeks in a row to get through all of it. It was very thorough and extensive. But I remember something happening like the book suggests will happen. I began to feel like I could look the world in the eye. My fears did begin to fall from me. The feeling that the drink problem had gone came very strongly. Up till then, I'd had certain spiritual beliefs, but I believe I began to have a spiritual experience. The desire to drink had been gone for a number of months by this point, but I was still living up in my head and very insecure, and this fifth step really set me straight. Now, I went back home for 6 and 7, and I didn't take the book from the shelf, by the way. It was in my hand. So I know it says from the shelf, but you can absolutely disregard that suggestion. And I remember waiting the hour and going over this inventory and looking at this inventory and these listed defects. And I remember something my sponsor said that was running through my head is, this is the best you got, Oliver. With no God, no AA in your life. This is your toolbox. These defects, this is like what you bring to the table. And man, it hit home that inventory was not only my past, it was my future. That was going to be my future. And I believed it. I knew it was true. And I did the seventh step prayer. And the funny thing about the seventh step, I thought it was like a magic bullet, guys. I thought that, like, this is just, it's going to be like page 417. It's just going to, like, immediately solve all my problems all the time. I had to be explained that after saying that seventh step prayer, I should act or live as if those defects have been removed, which was, like, kind of a bummer, because it kind of said that in AA, when I know what doing better looks like, I have to then do better. I don't get like a buffer time period where I can know the right thing to do and do the wrong thing, which would have been great. And I still lived as if there was some sort of buffer for a while. I remember having the thought of all the selfishy type stuff. I need to do it all before I get through the steps. I remember having that thought. I don't know if anyone else has had that thought, but I had it. And I remember by this point in the progress, I was looking forward to the chance to make some of these amends. And, you know, the first amends, I didn't tackle the hardest one first, as I've heard it suggested by lots of old-timers. I tackled like a 3 out of 10 first, and I was terrified. But I discovered something that's been true of all my amends, is the scariest part is before I start talking. The 30 seconds leading up to the amends is just by far the scariest. Once it gets going, it's actually not that bad. And, you know, I remember most of them have went well. Some friends have reminded me that if I were to go back, that nothing's changed. I won't be there again. You know, and I needed to hear that from them because I get what I've done. I had an amends I had to make to that friend who had passed away on my basement floor. And that was tough, you know. All these other amends, at least there's some feedback. Positive, negative, doesn't matter. At least there's someone talking back to me saying this or that. And I'm like, okay, I can, there's some kind of flow to it. But this amends, it's back in February, I want to say, and it's cold as hell, and I'm sitting there at this grave site, and I didn't know where his grave was, and I had to walk for about 20 minutes to find it, and that was kind of anxiety-ridden. I remember sitting down and reading that letter to him, and no one said a thing. No one said anything back to me. It was just me. And that was hard, you know, not getting that feedback, but I'm happy that I've done that. And that's the type of things I get to do now that I'm clean and sober. And that I'm staying sober. I get to set things right that I should have set right a long time ago. And it was tough. And I remember moving on in the steps to, you know, of course, 10, 11, 12, and my sponsor reminding me of the 10th step promises. This is all so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. He kept saying that shit like over and over. So long. This is how you'll react so long as you're staying in fit spiritual condition. Also, I think it's kind of a bum move that they tell us on page 85 we're not cured. Like, after I've done all the steps, you're like, hey, by the way, this isn't a permanent, everlasting thing, you know. They would have told me that at the beginning. I may not have done it. I remember, you know, my sponsor emphasizing on step 11 that all I'm praying for is the knowledge of his will and the power to carry it out. That's it. If it's outside that, you know, I need to reevaluate what I'm doing there. And in sobriety, the real work, I've had lots of events. The fourth step was an event. The fifth step was an event. My amends were events. But the work has been in 6 and 7. The consistent work. Being willing to have God remove a defect of character of mine. Which, from my experience, I'll hit my head again. And at some point, I'm willing. And being able to be aware of these defects of character and not pick them up as I used to pick up a bottle of vodka. But some of them feel pretty good. I'll pick up a bottle of gossip and just pour it all over my face. You know, pick up a bottle of justified anger and just get drunk on it. You know, that's a warm, cool buzz in my chest. You know, warms me up. But it's a waste of my time. It's an absolute waste of the hours that I could be happy. I'm squandering by being mad. And I see that today. And I try to practice these principles in my affairs, and I've discovered that these spiritual principles will solve all my problems. Living in the now is 90% of the battle. But that's tough. I have a tendency to be afraid I'm going to lose something I have or not get something I want, and I'm all up in my head about it, and I'm way out of the present moment. And I have no connection to God, and I'm not useful to anyone, including myself. But I have to stay aware of these things, and so far, it's been great. I'd say today that I'm grateful to be an alcoholic, and I mean it. I see people who go through life without any of these tools that we have. We have them here for free. I get to face life on a totally different playing field with a totally different set of tools than most people, and for that I'm grateful. And I have to use them. It's a little bit more serious for me. The consequences of not using them can be extreme, but. You know, I'm very grateful to have been here with you guys tonight, and thank you for having me speak.
what I tell you? How about another hand for Allie? Tinsley, would you do the honors? Giving out the chips.
My name is Tinsley. I'm an alcoholic. Thanks again for the story. That was really great. That's about the fastest that an hour has gone by in a long time, which is a good thing. Kept me on the seat of on the edge of my seat. Okay, so here at this meeting, we have a chip system to mark our time away from our last drink. If you'd like to try this way of life one day at a time, we offer a white chip. Anybody else for a white chip? After 30 days, we have a silver chip. I don't know what color this is. There's a gold chip for 60 days. Red chip for 90 days. Yellow chip for 6 months. Green chip for 9 months. Anybody got 1 year or multiples? Anybody want to reconsider on the white chip? Big hand for the chips you hold.
Like Oliver tonight. Wow. Again, thank you, Oliver. You really delivered. I remind each of you that anonymity is a spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
Stuck on me.